Welcome to Mom Talk Radio, the show that tackles topics important to you and your family. Finances, food, education, technology, and everything in between. We've got it covered on Mom Talk. Now, Mary Donnellan on Mom Talk Radio.
Yes, it's Mary in for Maria Bailey, who is taking a much needed and much deserved vacation with her oldest son and new daughter-in-law. So we wish Maria safe travels and a great vacation. And I just got back from vacation. It was obviously the week of July 4th when pretty much millions of other people were in the Florida Keys with me and my family. But we make it an annual trip and we had a wonderful time, even though it was hot. We were supposed to go to North Carolina, but we had to readjust. My 87-year-old dad is 87, so we had to kind of stick close to home. But it was a lovely trip nonetheless. And it just makes you appreciate vacation much more when you have to jump back into work. But I'm happy to be here behind the microphone today with a wonderful episode of Mom Talk Radio. And one of the guests we have, I'm so thrilled about, and I'm actually going to start talking about that first, because as I look at the summer schedule after vacation, I have to take my son, my husband and I have to take my son on college tours. And that will be actually one of our guests today. We are talking to Jennifer Fondler. She is an academic at Barnard. And she is the dean of enrollment, and she's going to actually tell us how to make the most out of those college tours and visits. And with a son in high school, a junior in high school, I know a lot of people in my circle are on road trips and flights all over the country looking at schools to get a good idea. So that's going to be a really great segment. And we also are going to be talking to tween book author Carlene Tausick. I hope I'm saying that right. And say tween because she writes books for mostly 8 to 12-year-olds. And this book she's going to talk about is When I Grow Up, I Want to Be. And that kind of works into a college situation because I had that conversation with my son last night. What do you want to be? So Carlene will be a great interview. And then we're going to be talking about new toothbrushes with today's Spotlight on Moms. That will be a really interesting discussion. And then we're talking to Vicki Hoffel. She is a Parenting as Partners author. She's a parent educator for 25 years. So she is going to be enlightening us on Parenting as Partners, one of her newest books. And as we approach the middle of July, as this show will air the week of the 16th, we are in the dog days of summer. And of course, I always think, well, that just means it's so hot that, you know, you just want to lay around on the porch panting like a dog because it's so hot. But actually, as if you've listened to the show and heard me before, you know that I am a trivia buff. So from the trivia desk of Mom Talk Radio, I found out where did that come from? Because I love cliches and I probably overuse them, as my friends will admit. Dog Days of Summer is actually an astronomical event when the star Sirius, represented by the dog in ancient Greek Roman mythology, appears to rise and set with the sun. Of course, we know Sirius because it's the satellite radio app now, but it's got the little dog on it. So that's that little dog on your Sirius app, in your car radio or on your phone, as well as the dog in the sky, is a Greek and Roman mythology. It's an astronomical. It's the dogs, the stars that form the dog. So anyway, that's where the actual original phrase "Dog Days of Summer" came from. So whatever you're doing, I hope it's a cool one, and you and your kids are enjoying this. This break from the normal school routine. And when we come back, our first guest is going to be Carlene Tausick. She is the author of her 11th book, When I Grow Up, I Want to Be. We're going to take a quick break. And before we take a quick break, I want to mention Pre-Mama. Go to drinkpremama.com for great information about prenatal and lactation supplements. And we'll be right back after a short break.
This is Mom Talk Radio, the number one podcast for busy moms. Mom Talk Radio.
Our first guest of the show is Carlene Tausick. She is the author of 11 books for children 8 to 12 years old. Her goal as an author is to get kids to love reading. And I love reading, and I loved to read as a kid. I read everything, but I was reading in the era of Nancy Drew and the Bobbsey Twins books, and so I just dated myself. Welcome to Mom Talk Radio, Carlene.
Thank you, Mary. I read the same books when I was little.
Right. I think we're of the same era. So you are an author of 11 books. So that's a prolific career already. So tell us about the latest one, When I Grow Up, I Want to Be.
This is the one that I find the most interesting because I feel that it can have the greatest impact on our next generation. Right now, if you Google percentage of Americans who dislike their jobs. You'll find study after study that show that over 50% of Americans dislike or are even disengaged from their jobs. And I think that is a sad story. So I wrote this book to give your listeners an idea of what it looks like. Every age from 6 through 18 has a two-page spread. And on that two-page spread, there's about 5 or 6 questions for kids to answer just that year. It takes about maybe 20 minutes of their time each year. And there are questions like, when you have some spare time, what do you like to do? What do kids ask you for help with? Things like that to get them thinking about their true strengths and talents. So that year after year, they're logging in what they're really good at, what they've achieved that year, the things that they're particularly interested in, and so on. So that as they get older and get closer to when it's time to pick maybe a vocational school or a major for college, they have a clear record of what they're actually good at.
That's awesome, you know, because as I was in the intro, which I know you didn't hear, we were still calling you. I have a junior in high school, and I actually had the conversation with him last night. What, like, because he changes his mind a lot, and that's normal, I think. And that's why, I mean, please, that's why some kids, you know, go to college and don't get out in 4 years. But it's really fascinating that you've given them sort of the roadmap in this book.
Yes, I hope so. Having been in human resources for 15 years, I realize that people who are working in an area of strength have a greater rate of success, a greater rate of receiving raises and advancement because they're happy in their job. And that attitude makes all the difference.
Absolutely. And actually, when I was, again, without dating myself, this book was out right when I was graduating college. And it was called Do What You Love. And I thought even just that phrase itself, regardless of what the book said, was very meaningful, you know, do what you love. So you're, let me mention your website really quick, carlenet.com. That's K-A-R-L-E-E-N-T. If my son is 17, is he too old then, or can he still kind of write in at the 17-year-old page?
And you could certainly give it a go, but I recommend it for ages 6 to 12. Because I think that by the time kids get into their adolescent years, they start getting pulled by well-meaning guidance counselors, peer pressure, different factors that are involved in these decisions. And sometimes they can get pulled in the wrong direction. And plus, too, when they hit adolescence, they start forgetting some of those things from their younger years. So I do recommend it for 6 to 12 primarily, although the book does go through to age 18.
Right. Well, I heard that. That's why I thought, oh, I've got one more year. But you're right. Yeah, I think at this point they're molded. Not molded. I mean, shoot, they say they don't, you know, teenage brains don't really develop until their 20s. But I still think those more, like you said, 6 to 12, those are more probably unfiltered answers.
Yes.
And would you agree?
I do agree. But I think that some of the questions in there, even adults, gain value from, because there's so many adults that get to a certain point in their life and they're ready for a change, but they don't know what that change should be because they're not in tune with these questions.
True. You should, since you know the statistic at 50% of Americans dislike any jobs, you should write it for, modify it for the adult populations.
I've thought about it, but there are a lot of good books out there about for the adult population.
True.
But I have had adults look at this book and say, wow, I wish I had this when I was a kid. I've heard that many, many times.
Absolutely. I bet you have. So where can our listeners find the book?
It's primarily on Amazon. The easiest way to find it, because I have a difficult last name to spell if you were going to search that way. And there are about 1,000 books called When I Grow Up on Amazon, which I didn't realize when I gave it that title. But the easiest way to find it is to put in Career Possibility Journal, and it'll pop right up to the top.
Okay. Career Possibility Journal. Okay.
Yes. Right.
So
that's the subtitle of the book.
Right. So would you say that you have this is something that parents do with their child or children, correct? And you said it's only 20 minutes, but tell us a little bit about the book. I guess I'm also asking, like, so when the child can read the book on their own, or is it something that mom or dad has to do with them?
During those early years, they might need help with reading the questions, but I would advocate more of a hands-off process on how they fill it in. You know, and plus I've made it kind of in a coloring book format so that they can decorate it however they like according to their taste and so on. But I think that the role for parents or grandparents, should they choose to get it or whoever, would be to pick a day out of the year to pull the book off the shelf and say, hey, let's sit down, do this for, you know, a few minutes and fill this in just for the year. Maybe that's the day after their birthday or the first day of summer vacation or some low-key day that they can remember. This is the day when we do this, Daylight Savings Day. We're going to change the batteries in the smoke alarm and we're going to do the career book. Something like that. It's memorable that it can be kept up with each year.
Okay. Yeah. And you so like their birthday, like you said, or some specific day of the year when it's very notable. Interesting. Yes. So you came up with the idea. Are the other your prior books similar in this you said they're all for children's 6 to 12. Are the books along the same bent?
Not at all. They're all fiction. All the rest of them are contemporary fiction books, primarily for ages 8 to 12.
Awesome. Go
ahead.
No, go ahead.
I have a trilogy called the Maximum Magic series. My husband is actually a professional magician. So I base that storyline on the fact, on the fascination that I see the kids have with magicians.
Okay. Oh, that's neat. Mm-hmm. Oh, so that's interesting. So let's check it out. I'm going to tell listeners again, you can go to carleent.com, K-A-R-L-E-E-N-T.com. You can find her latest book on Amazon. Thank you so much for joining us, Carleen, and for coming up with a really great, useful book for kids and their parents. And when we come back, we'll shine the spotlight on moms. Get ready. We're talking about how often you're supposed to change your toothbrush. Believe it or not, stay with us. We'll take a quick break.
Talk Radio, a busy mom's best friend.
It's the Spotlight on Moms that we're shining on Ann Sophie Saman. She has two children and blogs at getnewtoothbrush.com and on Twitter at get_toothbrush. And that is our topic. Ann Sophie, everyone knows we need to change our family's toothbrushes. Is that what is the general time frame that we are supposed to?
It's usually at least every 3 months. That's what the guidelines are. Obviously not set by me, but, you know, by the dental community. And, well, the reasons are actually a couple, and they're very, very simple. One is efficiency, because obviously, you know, as you keep brushing, the brush itself, you know, kind of gets worn, whether or not you see it, because sometimes, you know, your toothbrush looks just fine, but, you know, you're talking microscopically not fine. So that's why they say 3 months and not when you see your toothbrush is worn out, because that would not be a good way to detect that, for example. So that's the same thing, because it's, you know, it's the first thing, I'm sorry, it's, you know, what ruins your enamel somehow, your gums. So that's, you know, the very first thing that, you know, explains why you need to change, you know, your toothbrush when you might feel it's not, you know, necessary. And the second is actually because of cleanliness. I don't know if you're aware of that, but we have, you know, about 10 million bacteria on your, on our toothbrushes. So obviously,
how many? How many?
10 million.
10 million bacteria?
Yeah, you're going to look at your toothbrush like, oh, yuck. Yes. Yeah, that's exactly like that. It's and if I just name a few, you know, then it's really the, you're gonna start, you know, gagging. It's Streptococcus, E. coli, Staphylococcus, and you even have, believe it or not, some poop stuff on the toilet right next to where your toothbrushes are. So every time you flush your toilet, you know, the bacteria start to be, you know, airborne and land there. Or if you're
It's airborne?
Yeah, it gets airborne, actually. It doesn't just go down like we might see it. So it's actually, you know, scientifically proven that this is what you need. That's the guideline you want to follow if you don't want to.
I believe you. And it's not a conspiracy to just let the toothbrush companies make more money, you're saying, either. Scientists have stepped in and said that this is definitely something we should do. So when I get to the store and I go to my drugstore or my grocery store, I mean, I'm overwhelmed by the number of toothbrush styles and not even the colors. I mean, and the pricing, by the way, some are $1.99, some are $5 and $6.99. And that's not even counting the electric toothbrushes that are, you know, those, that's an interesting, and I just thinking of my own point, they have replaceable heads on those. So those are the 3 month kind, even though the bottom isn't, right?
Well, when you mention electrical toothbrushes, well, they're not set up to be, you know, replaced every 3 months. Again, that would be you going to the store every 3 months. And if you want, we'll go back to the electrical toothbrushes in a little bit. The first thing to know about toothbrushes really is that less is more. If you don't take, you know, a bad brush, you know, I would steer clear from usually the simpler brushes because they don't necessarily have the end tip, you know, proper for that. But overall, they all work. Now, again, less is more in the sense that you don't need all the gimmicks. It's a lot of times, you know, and you were talking about the industry that sense. Yes, you do need to change it every 3 months, but a lot of things are just a little bit playing on the ignorance of the general public. And yes, they try to sell you, you know, 360 heads and things like that, you know. When it becomes way too much, usually it's just to try and convince people. It's not necessary. The ADA, by the way, you know, really says in the same, you know, line as I'm saying to you now, and actually what I'm telling you is actually what's out there, you know, scientifically proven. Simple is good with toothbrushes. You have to be careful of one main thing with toothbrushes. They need to be soft bristled unless your dentist recommend you an extra soft, which is quite rare, actually. Because anything else will have more, you know, inclination to have problem with your gums or enamel.
Right.
So it's you know, it's something that's a very strong point that the ADA makes.
And I had heard that actually about a couple of years ago. My dentist finally said, you know, like, you just need it to soft as you can get. That's the kind of brush you need. Because that was my last question, because we only have about 20 seconds. So tell our listeners where they can find more information, because your website, you also offer tips for babies and brushing too. So what's your website?
It's getnewtoothbrush.com. And we have toothbrushes for the whole family, the right ones you need, the ones that won't create confusion because you have all the colors you need, because usually that's what people care about.
Right.
But otherwise, you don't have the headache of going through, what should I take? We've picked what you should take according to the ADA, which is, again, you know, the big instance for everything dental, really.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us and enlightening us on our toothbrushes. So get out there and change your toothbrushes, folks. And we'll be right back after this quick break.
Mom Talk Radio, a busy mom's best friend. Now, Mary Donnellan on Mom Talk Radio.
This is Mary and for Maria, and we're continuing our discussion about moms and our happiness and stress-free lives. And we're actually going to talk about expectant moms with Dr. Allie Domar. So it was Alice, but it's Allie Domar. She's the author of Finding Calm for the Expectant Mom and is a founder and executive director of the Domar Centers for Mind-Body Health. And she's a busy mom herself. She is driving right now to get her daughter, and she is in on the Mass Pike driving to the Berkshires. So welcome to Mop Talk Radio, Dr. Domar.
Thank you so much. This is a classic mom, you know, doing two things simultaneously.
Yeah. So as our producer said, let's stay safe. You're on your Bluetooth on your phone, and that's good. We're glad you can find the time to talk to us. So let's talk about it. So your book, you're the author of the book Finding Calm for the Expectant Mom, and it's all about what? Tell us.
Well, you know, people always ask me why I wrote this book, and I say there are two reasons. One is that I think there's a societal pressure for pregnant women to glow, to be radiant, to be happy, to be serene. And, you know, I'm a psychologist, and I see pregnant patients pretty much every day. And for a lot, you know, yes, there's certainly some women who love every second of their pregnancy, and I never see those women. But there are a lot of women out there who find it hard to be pregnant. You know, you can have physical symptoms, you can have psychological symptoms, and people often don't feel okay complaining about it. And so one of the reasons I wrote the book was to say, you know what, a lot of these things that you're feeling, the uncomfortableness, the depression, the anxiety, it's really normal. And here are ways to feel better while you're pregnant. I was writing a blog the other day about irritability, and I was listing all the reasons why pregnant women can feel irritable. And you know what? There are a lot of them. You know, you get hungry, but you don't know that you're hungry because you're nauseous. And you're really tired because you're not sleeping well at night. And, you know, you and your partner may be responding to this pregnancy in different ways. And weird people come up and touch you. I just saw a patient today. She's sick and tired of perfect strangers coming up, putting their hands on her belly.
The belly touch, yep. It's very random, isn't it?
So intrusive. So,
yes.
You know, and then, you know, your in-laws might say you have to name the baby pen. Or you just don't feel like you're most attractive. Or, I mean, there are lots of reasons why you should be irritable while you're pregnant. And I consider that normal. But, you know, if you're the average woman who goes into social media and all people talk about is how great they feel, it makes the average pregnant woman feel like she's not doing a good job being pregnant, or maybe she shouldn't be having a baby. And like, no, this is hard. It's hard work to build a baby.
Your book basically sounds like the realistic guide to pregnancy, the up, the hot, the good, and the not so good. I don't want to say bad, because actually only amongst my girlfriends, like my really close girlfriends, would we ever say, oh my God, pregnancy sucked, you know, or parts of it did, not all of it, but there were parts where you just were like, that was not fun.
Well, you know, I was talking to a colleague of mine a couple of years ago, and I was telling her about writing this book, and she said that a strange thing happened when she got pregnant with her second baby. She was talking to a colleague of hers who had, like, two perfect pregnancies. And when the perfect colleague asked my colleague, you know, how are you doing? And my colleague said, well, you know, I'm really nauseous. I'm having a hard time sleeping. I'm having leg cramps. And the perfect colleague says, oh, yeah, that's right. I forget you hate being pregnant. And my colleague is like, no, that's not it.
No, I don't. Yeah.
No, I love the fact that I'm, you know, bringing my children into the world. It's just, I'm talking honestly about how uncomfortable it can be to be pregnant. And people misinterpret that. So it's okay to be uncomfortable. It's okay to complain about it. And so, yes, the book is about acknowledging that and trying to fix the things you can fix so you can feel better.
If you're struggling with pregnancy emotions, where does the red flag come in that it's probably something a little bit more?
You know, I'm getting really sick and tired of this huge battle that's being sort of fought in the obstetrical and psychiatry world as to whether or not a woman who's pregnant should be taking antidepressant medication. And everyone talks about either yes, she should, or no, she shouldn't. And no one ever talks about what the alternatives are. There are other things that can treat depression other than medication. And so clearly, if a woman is severely depressed, if she's suicidal, if she's having suicidal thoughts, if she can't get out of bed, if she's, you know, if she's hurting herself because of her depression, then of course she should be on medication. There's no question. But for the 90% of pregnant women who are taking medication or have a history of depression, maybe it's a better idea to try other things first, and specifically cognitive behavior therapy, which has been shown over and over again to be as effective as medication in treating mild to moderate depression.
So other than medication, there are options and women should explore.
Absolutely. You know, I'm not saying don't take medication, but I'm saying you should try something else first, and if it doesn't work, then try medication.
Right. And the website is Dr. Alice, A-L-I-C-E, Domar, DOMAR.com. And we'll have that link up on Mom Talk Radio next week.
This is Mom Talk Radio, the number one podcast for busy moms. Mom Talk Radio.
She is the author of Parenting as Partners. She is a sought-after coach, speaker, and professional parent educator with 25 years of experience teaching kids how to raise children who are respectful, responsible, and resilient. Don't we all want that? Welcome to Mom Talk Radio, Vicki.
Thanks for having me.
So your book is Parenting as Partners. Tell us, did it just launch, or
yes.
Tell us a little bit about it.
I've been doing parent coaching for about 20 years, but in the last 5 years, I started to notice a kind of shift in the trend where parents used to come together and talk about a challenge with the child, and they seemed to be able to get on the same page relatively quickly. Suddenly, the conversation was changing, and it was more about the discord between the partners, the couples. Both had different ideas about what was best for the kids. And I tried to find resources for them, and as it turns out, there just isn't a lot on the market about how to co-parent when you're married. There's a lot of information about how to co-parent if you're divorced, but what if you don't want to be divorced in order to learn how to do that? So the book
That's
kind
interesting.
Of
interesting
came
point.
Out
you're right.
Of that.
We've actually interviewed, just thinking in terms of our guests on this show, we've interviewed plenty of how to parent as a single mom, as a single dad, as, you know, in a mixed family, as steps and, you know, step parents. So it's interesting if you're just still with a life partner and how you parent. A very good, very good point.
I think we take it for granted that because we both agree that we want to have children and that initial kind of honeymoon stage where we look at each other and say, this is what I think we should do. And your partner goes, yeah, me too. And we think, well, that's all we needed was this kind of very loose agreement. And that works for a few years until the kids' personalities emerge. And suddenly the simplest thing, like whether the kids will sit at the table or whether they can wander around, becomes an issue. And that's before we get to the big issues about, you know, what if you catch your child lying or stealing, or, you know, how do you feel about drinking underage?
Mm-hmm.
And so I felt like it was time to address kind of that missing piece in parenting as a way to help couples navigate through and not only stay together, but really solidify their partnership when it comes to raising their kids.
That is outstanding because, again, from the trenches, I have two teenagers as well as a 10-year-old. So I think the teenage years have been so challenging from, again, a parenting perspective with their father. I mean, it has been, and again, good kids. We're very, very blessed. But sometimes I just look at them and I think, when they were little, we didn't have these, we didn't have any big things, you know. It was so, because it was not, again, there wasn't as much emotional, emotional issues involved. Where, you know, one child is polar opposite of the other. So every time there's something comes up, I have to recalculate, you know, and think, wait, that's not, you know, you're not the child that needs this. You need that, you know. So
there are all kinds of combination. Each of our children are different. As a couple, we come into parenting with our own ideas about what's best for the kids, even though for most of us, we're not able to articulate that until there's a real challenge in front of us. And unfortunately, we rely on our own childhoods to grab that information and make a very quick parenting decision. And oftentimes, we can't even explain to our partner why we think this is best for the kids. And that's kind of where the rub comes, is if you have two stubborn people who both think their way is the right way, how do you navigate through that together cooperatively and collaboratively and come to an agreement that's in the best interest of the kids?
Absolutely. Yes, I felt like you were just shining a mirror and or you've been peeking into my household. Two stubborn, strong-willed parents, and I have two stubborn, strong-willed teenagers too. So it's like, woo, it's a bunch of battering rams going at it. But in your book, you provide the six keys to success for implementing a plan for parenting as partners. Can you just touch on the top, maybe the top two or your top favorites?
Well, I think the most important thing is our ability to admit that maybe we're not the best communicators when we're feeling defensive or attacked or judged. And I think so oftentimes, if we can really start to understand how communication really works in partnerships, that's a huge key to the success. And it's quite simple to do with a couple of small minor tweaks, which I talk about in the book. The other thing I think that is so important is that we have the courage to look at our own lives and say, I think maybe I've gone off the rails in this area, and I'm willing to take responsibility for that. And I'm willing to listen to my partner and try and understand his point of view or her point of view without attacking first. And I think that takes a lot of courage. And I think most of us are pretty defensive about, you know, our beliefs and our values. And when we can take a deep breath, and look at our partner and agree that we want what's best for the kids. Sometimes that's all it takes to get things moving.
Right. And to put aside, again, as you mentioned in the last comment, put aside our own beliefs we brought into parenting from our own childhood, as well as put aside all, you know, all of our history and make it about the kids, not about our ego or, you know, our opinion, our strongly held beliefs. And give me an idea about the book's format. Is it more of like each chapter is an anecdote and then some tips, or is it more just, you know, how to strategies and tips?
It's actually designed as a workbook so that each parent can go back to a certain issue that. So let's say that bedtime has become a problem for you and your partner in terms of coming up with a strategy. You can go back and do a quick exercise and get to the root of what you believe as a parent now about bedtime based on your childhood. And when you have that aha moment, you're suddenly willing to release that belief and open up to the other possibilities. And when your partner does the same thing, it means that all the things you'd never considered before are now available to you. So it's really meant for partners to be able to pick an area of life with their kids that they might be, you know, frustrated with, and very quickly do this exercise, come back together, share what they've learned about themselves, and then come up with a plan that they both agree on and that they can execute.
Okay. So it's the workbook is a really good example. That's great for most parents. So is it more or less the big issues and you can basically look it up in the index and say, okay, bedtime, or, you know, or is it more about more or less just some leading questions that could be pretty general?
No, they're very specific. So there's everything from relationships between siblings and parents and friendships and what do you believe about them and where did those beliefs come from? And then there's the kind of everyday things that we think of with kids, getting up in the morning, manners, eating, homework, you know, dating, and then the kind of value-based issues that we deal with. How do we feel about, you know, religion or sports or all of those kinds of things that we talk about with our partners, but very often we don't really come to an agreement about how we want to approach it with our kids. It's more like, well, we'll deal with it when it happens. And then, as you may or may not know, I certainly know in my life, that's when things start to go downhill because there is no plan.
Oh, yes. Right. And looking back, I would say, you know, again, you think you know your partner and it's a little bit naive to not expect that there'll be some roadblocks, you know, or some little bumps in the road. Some are bigger, some are smaller. But again, you know, as I say, if you can survive teenage years. So the book, again, is called Parenting as Partners and is available on Amazon and at smaller bookstores, did you say?
Yep. Your local indie bookstore should carry it as well.
Okay. Wonderful. Thank you so much, Vicki. And your website is Vicki Hoefele. It's VickiHoefele.com. And does the website offer information about this as well? Or just
it sure
what
does.
Is the website offer?
Yep.
Thank you so much for joining us. And when we come back after a short break, Jennifer Fondler will be here. She is the admissions director, Dean of Enrollment at Barnard, and is going to talk to us about college tours. We'll be right back.
Mom Talk Radio, a busy mom's best friend.
As I mentioned at the top of the show, I am in the midst of college tours with my soon-to-be senior son, and I have the perfect guest to address all of this. Jennifer Fondler is a Barnard College academic, and she has been with Barnard since August 2000 as Dean of Enrollment Management, Admissions, Financial Aid, and a Registrar. So she's got a whole host of experience. So welcome to Mom Talk Radio, Jennifer.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. So tell us a little bit about your role at Barnard since you've been there 17 years.
Yeah, I've been there a long time. And I work very closely with admissions. I'm responsible for the recruitment and selection of applicants from all across the country and throughout the world. And it means that I am meeting them on their home turfs in their high school settings, but also thousands and thousands of students who come to visit our campus as well. And then later on, am reading all of their applications and working with a team to make decisions.
Oh, okay. So, yeah, you have a broad range of experience and actually influence, I would say. You're who we want to talk to, and I'm the parent that wants to talk to you. Is it summer? Summer's typically the peak of college tours and visits, correct?
Definitely, definitely. Summer's a great time to see what's out there. And, you know, for families that are just starting out, it's also a time that you don't have to get too in-depth, but you can just take a tour and just sort of like people watch and get a sense of how big a campus is or what is, you know, what's the area like, that kind of thing. So it's a great time because everybody has a little more time in the summer too.
Right. But in general, the whole process, we've already been to the Chicago area and did some schools there. So, and again, over the next month, my husband and I are tag teaming. We're taking him to three different states, visiting probably 10 schools. It's stressful. It's stressful.
I
already can feel my stress ratcheting it up. So what do we do to help us and our kids?
Well, I think it'd be very stressful. First, just managing all of that and also trying to communicate, because you may be on one page and your son or daughter may be on another page. So I think what's really important is to kind of develop expectations of when we go to this, like what's their priority and what's your priority? You know, do they want to talk to students? Do they just want to take a tour and not talk to anybody? Or maybe they are going to meet with a coach, or they want to, they're really interested in an academic department, so they do want to go up and see what faculty members are around. Many schools also offer interviews, and that might be something that that a student might want to do. But I think it's hard when you're visiting so many schools too. It's like a whirlwind, right? That you almost feel like you're not even getting out of the car sometimes,
right?
Because you got to get to the next school. So trying to kind of develop those expectations so everybody, you know, nobody sort of feels disappointed, I think.
Right. And by expectations, I'm trying to manage that through some research. And the website, a school website is obviously your first line of information, source of information, correct?
They're great. They're great. And, you know, it's always good to be able to get to a college campus knowing a little bit of information. And I find that parents and children often are a little split on that, because students are a little bit sometimes late to the pickup on doing some of that research, and parents love to do research. You know, I think parents should start where they're at, and I think students often use the campus visit to kickstart that, whereas I think parents sometimes have already done a little bit more research. But I also think it's really important in this process to empower your children, so that I often find when families show up at our admissions office, the family walks in the door and a parent walks up to the front desk and says, "We're here for the interview." And I kind of want to say, "No, back away. Your child is here for the interview." And to, you know, call the child up to the front desk. Any moments where you can really let them take charge. With my own children, I really said to them, "Look, you need to make the phone calls and set up the appointments." And I was standing right behind them in case they didn't know what to say, but I really pushed them to do that, because I think in the end, it builds a lot of confidence in them to take ownership over this process.
That's a great point. And, you know, it's our nature to just fly in and say, I'll go to the front desk, because the kids can be obviously a little more shy than we are, or a little more hesitant, especially if they see a room full of fellow, you know, high schoolers or peers, it's a little overwhelming. But you're right, make them do it. Push them a little bit out of the nest, right?
Right.
So where can we find information from your website? And one more tip, we got about 30 seconds.
www.barnard.edu. What colleges look for, I think, is interest in a student. When we're giving an information session, I don't want to see a student falling asleep. I want them to be engaged and maybe ask me a question or two about application tips that we might be able to give them. We have a lot of information, so we'd love to be able to share that with them too.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Jennifer. And Jennifer, your school is actually the school that it was, my sorority was founded there. In the 1800s. So thank you so much for joining us, Jennifer, and thank everyone for listening to this wonderful edition of Mom Talk Radio. And Maria will be back behind the mic next week. Have a wonderful week.